My guest today is Martin Durkin. And Martin Durkin, what is new?
Well, what's new is that you and I both have a film out spreading around the world like some wicked virus, confirming all the skeptics and their beliefs, and maybe rattling the certitude of a couple of greenies. I don't know whether, but anyway, that's new. But I think you've got your finger on the pulse even more than me in terms of how that film is doing at the moment. So what do you think?
Yeah, I'm ecstatic as to how it's doing so far. That like on Twitter, so many copies of the movie are on Twitter. The Wide Awake Media guy put one up, and that copy has 1.1 million views. And then there's lots of other copies of the movie that have 100,000, 200,000 views. I put up one myself just as a throwaway thing with captions, and right away that got 220,000 views and still climbing. And lots of clips are going up everywhere. So I'm very happy that so many people are watching it and so many people are commenting on it. Chris Martz put up a commentary on it, and his tweets commenting on it got 220,000 views, I think, already. So there's just so much stuff going on. It makes me very happy. And we're only a week in. Just now today, Toby Young put up a good article praising it in The Spectator. He said, quote, "It is a dazzlingly entertaining film that distills the case against climate alarmism into a succinct 80 minutes, end quote. So I'm very happy.
The Spectator, is it?
Yeah, in The Spectator.
Oh, well, I've got to copy The Spectator that hasn't been opened. I'll do that.
Yeah. I was going to just talk to you about the difference between releasing this movie versus releasing the Swindle, Great Global Warming Swindle in 2007. So different, right? Because Twitter wasn't even, it was an infant back then, it was barely around in 2007. So when you released Swindle, it just went out just on TV, just in Great Britain, is that right, at first?
It went out on Channel 4 in the UK, and then subsequently got bought by a number of other channels. In other countries, never got broadcast in the US. A lot of stations are a bit nervous of taking it, but that was a very different sort of film. On the first of all, I had Ofcom sort of and Channel 4 lawyers breathing down my neck, so I couldn't say exactly what I wanted to say in the film. But also, it was a very quick turnaround, so it was there were a couple of mistakes on graphs and things like that, and. Which, you know, oh, bloody hell, wish I'd got those right. I didn't understand the subject as well. I didn't understand the issue, I think, as well as I do now. You know, the stuff about the nature of the consensus, the nature of the beast. It was quite a learning curve shoving that out, because, you know, when it went out, it was like the ceiling fell in on me. You know, it was just, I thought, oh my God, this is not just a question about science. This isn't just a science issue. There's so much more going on than that. And I suppose it was the making of the Swindle that made me realize that fully. But the Swindle, I mean, I think already our film's been out a week, and I think it's probably been seen by more people already than saw the Great Global Warming Swindle. So, you know, I think this is going to be much, much bigger.
Yeah, I think you're right. I didn't know, did you do some self-censoring then when you did Swindle? You knew ahead of time, oh, I can't say that, or Ofcom is going to get me in lots of trouble?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't self-censoring. It was other people censoring me. The Channel 4 lawyer sort of waded in and said, you can't say that, you can't say that. Oh. And Ofcom compliance meant that, you know, I needed to have, you know, the opposition come in and give critical sort of comments within the film. Oddly enough, they refused. So it ended up, but I had to go through the process of asking Michael Mann and all these people who said they wouldn't have anything to do with me. I mean, luckily already my reputation was so bad by that stage that they wouldn't be in the film, which is a good thing, because there's a sort of film where you mug the other side. And I certainly think there's scope for not me to do, but other people to do films where, you know, they manage to get interviews with some of the big global warmers and then embarrass them with some basic questions. But sometimes you want a film where you're just able to put one side of the argument in its entirety in as forceful a way that you can. And I think we did that.
So would you say that the blowback that you experienced in that first week in 2007 was way like orders of magnitude bigger than any blowback you've seen now, which is almost nothing in the mainstream media for this one?
Well, it was sort of different because it had gone out on Channel 4, and so Ofcom could they were allowed to complain to Ofcom. And so Ofcom has the power to sanction Channel 4. So Channel 4 comes to me saying, you better, you know, defend this against Ofcom, otherwise, we're not going to, you're going to be in trouble with us. Actually, Channel 4 did do the decent thing and hired a barrister and a producer, another producer, for about 6 months after Swindle went out to cope with the barrage of complaints, clearly orchestrated. A lot of them were using the same language to Ofcom about us, and that was, commercially that was all. Because I was a film producer, director with a small independent production company trying to make a living, and I was having to do this, unpaid defense of this film for the best part of a year, and Channel 4, even the Channel 4 had asked me to make the film. Himesh Bakura, wonderful head of science at the time at Channel 4, sadly died. I didn't get another commission from Channel 4 for 3 years after that, which, at the time was a really big, a big problem. So that was huge. It was sort of, I was thinking, is this going to wreck my career? My income took a nosedive. All of that stuff. So I really empathize with those scientists who say, you really don't want to speak out about this because it will get you into serious trouble. I've experienced that directly myself. So, and in a way, that was what I wanted to incorporate that into the film. Why has this become a kind of moral thing? Why is this a thing which will, endanger your livelihood if you speak out about it? That's the really weird thing about this subject.
Do you agree with the thing I've been saying that right now is a good time for the movie to come out, since so many people were questioning COVID and the lockdowns, that the public is far more ready to hear it now than it was in 2007?
Well, I think you're right that one of the central issues here is one's trust and faith in authority. And the establishment wants to say, we're the experts, take it from us on everything, on the economy, on COVID, on climate, and I think on all those fronts, the economy, they're thinking, who are these buggers in charge? I mean, look at the public debt that we're in. Look at the inflation that's taken off with all their money printing. These people don't know what they're... These people are scoundrels and don't know what they're doing, and they seem to be self-serving. And with COVID, the amount of nonsense that we talk about COVID, but you could sense in COVID the urge of a certain group of people who liked lockdown, who believed in, wanted to assert, the authority of the experts, and had all those instincts, versus another group who actually were thinking, this is God's will. If it doesn't add up, these experts are kind of, they've got their own axe to grind and so on. And so, as you say, coming off the back of that, I think people are now thinking, is climate just, another example of that? I think there was a lot of skepticism swilling around anyway, but I think the anger's growing. I think the anger is, you can see it across the Western world, anger against what might loosely be called, the publicly funded establishment. A lot of parties and politicians who are deemed to be against the swamp, the blob, whatever you might call them, are doing terrifically well. I mean, really in many, many countries. I mean, Donald Trump is an example of that. He might be a ginger billionaire, but for all his failings, sort of personally, he's enormously popular because he's deemed to be on the other side of this appalling blob. And so you're right. I think it's come at the right time.
So you said, I think earlier, that there was enough fear of cancellation that people worked on the movie with you, and then in the credits, they had to use different names because they're afraid if people find out their real names that they might not get hired again, things like that.
Yeah. No, that's the case. I mean, they were happy to work on it, and, it was a fantastic team, but there was just that nervousness. That especially the young ones, the sort of older ones who got established, it was exactly parallel with the scientists. The younger ones thought, if word gets around that I've worked on this, then I could just lose work.
One thing I wanted to talk about unrelated is translations of the movie, that already there are 10 translated versions of this movie. Did anyone do that for The Swindle? Was it translated into lots of other languages? I don't even know.
No, I don't think so. I think some individual broadcasters in different countries did it for. But again, when they went out in those countries, it would go out once on TV and that's it. So you get a certain number of hits on TV and that's it. It's over. You know, there was a bit of an afterlife because it got copied and shoved onto YouTube and things like that. But I think that, it's petering out. I mean, the astonishing thing, I remember when we were talking on your podcast before and you saying, it's still being cited, which, goes to show how effective their censorship has been, because it's not a formal censorship. There's no lit law that says you are not allowed to make a film like this. But the informal methods of censorship are so powerful that, there's not been another film like Swindle until yours.
It does make me happy, as we've discussed, that 16 or 17 years later on Twitter, I see people saying, have you seen this movie, The Great Global Warming Swindle? You got to see it because it's so powerful. I love that. And I do think that 10 plus years from now, people are still going to be referring back to this movie. I think it's going to have great legs. So that's good.
Yeah, well, I think in our early discussions, I think we said that, we're going to make this, we want to change the world, you want to actually change, make a tangible difference. I was going to say to the debate, there isn't really a debate, is there? It's a kind of war. and we're kind of the French resistance in the war. But we wanted to make a big impact with the film. And one week in, I hope that we might actually do it.
Yeah, I mean, just the Norwegian copy sitting on one channel, I think that it has over 25,000 views already. And then there's a move afoot right now to translate this into Asian languages. And I think there's going to be a big Asian audience for this in the next whatever month or so. I think it's we're going to see, this is just the start of the whole thing, I think. We're going to see so much more happening.
Yeah, and I don't know what you think of the tweets, but the interesting thing is the number of people who... it's like they're saying, I told you so. Now look at this. And they're sending it to other people and they're saying, look, and I think the trouble is a lot of people have been having conversations about this and, skeptics have been wondering about saying, this is all not true. And they've been dismissed as eccentrics and wackos and idiots. How can you be right? Joe blogs where all these scientists, line up in the opposite direction. So to have something that they can kind of refer to, which has got a bit of the science involved and then got a bit of the other arguments, is enormous. It's a tool, it's a weapon that they can use to justify their arguments, I think.
And then this whole kind of viral spread of how the movie is getting spread around just is making me so happy. I was just investigating this morning that there is a YouTube channel I had not heard of called Food Lies. And already we are the second most popular video from that channel. I don't even know who that guy is, but it's got over 150,000 views just on that channel that I hadn't heard of this person. And there's just a lot of examples of that people are downloading their own copy, which you can download it from the Substack. There's going to be a link in the show notes here. You can download your own copy and put it up. And I think a lot of people will be continuing to just kind of spread it everywhere. So that makes me very happy.
Yeah, the fact that it's going internationally, I mean, so many tweets, from in foreign tongues, it goes, blah, 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 climb of the movie, blah, 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 climb of the movie. and you think, I don't know what they're probably slagging us off, but you think it's great. This is going to all, going to every corner of the globe, as it were.
Yeah, I should give credit to the Clintel people, Marcel Kroc and his group. They're doing a great job of being the central hub for translating this movie. So they were saying it was hard the first time to figure out exactly how to do it, but now they're figuring out how to do it quicker, and they're kind of just cranking out translations very, very fast, which is fantastic.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And next time Marcel is in London, I've got to take him out for a slap-up feed and a good old drink. To thank him, because they've done fantastically well. All sorts of other people kind of worked tirelessly behind the scenes. Everyone from and helped out making the film. Willie Soom, Nir Shabib, all sorts of folk who have helped out and are continuing to do wonderful things, promoting it and the rest. So it's been a as you know, it's a collective effort.
It absolutely is. I mean, one person is Willie Soon has been helping us connect to translators for some of the Asian languages.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, he's doing a great job there. I wanted to give a shout out to Andy May, did a very nice annotated bibliography of the whole thing about, I think, 70 things that are said in the movie. And here's what backs up those things. Loving that. Yeah. And then there's two different people that did Twitter threads pushing back against some of the alleged debunking of the movie. Jim Steele did one of those, and Chris Martz did another one of those. So I have those. I have links to kind of all of this stuff in the movie FAQ page if you want to figure out more about what's happening with the pushback. And there's a whole, wanted to mention in IMDb now, there's kind of a humorous fight going on as people are rating the movie. Almost everybody says it's either a 10 or a 1. I think there's like 13 or 14 reviews out there. There's 1.9.
Sure sign of a class war. 1.9.
There's a 9. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's pretty funny. I have not seen anything yet on Rotten Tomatoes, but I think a lot more of that is to come too, since we're only 1 week in. So one thing I wanted to dig in here is something I don't even know about is your process. How did you go from this movie in your mind to a finished product? Did you have actual outlines that you wrote down, or how did this go? How'd you do it?
Oh, damn me. It's confusion and I'm sort of honing in. That's a really hard question to answer. I mean, one big thing is who's going to be in the film. So it's a lot of talking to people. And in the early stages, a lot of exploring the science, because that's, you know, you want to get the science right. You don't want to be hung out to dry there. And very early on, you know, from our discussions, you know, I wanted to be really modest about what we said about the science, you know, just keep it really simple, keep it to things that are pretty indisputed or undisputable. You know, I think to defeat them on the science front, you don't have to say, oh my God, I've discovered this obscure paper over here that says X, Y, Z. You know, what's the stuff that no one disagrees about? I wanted something where, and I think we've got it, where, you know, you're at a dinner party, you can say to someone, okay, you don't believe, you say it's too hot and CO2 is too high. Get your phone, Google Earth temperature 500 million years, press images, and tell me that, you know, it's too hot. And you can see that, you know, we're freezing our nuts off. And likewise, you know, you can say, like, put in CO2 levels 500 million years, tell me there's too much CO2 about the place. And, you know, you can see that CO2 is incredibly low. I mean, compared to the last 500 million years, I mean, incredibly low, worryingly low, if you know the importance of CO2. So, you know, these basic things, and look up hurricane activity. Oh, yeah, there are more storms. No, there aren't. No, even they don't say that there are more storms, you know, if you push them. Even they can't support this notion that there are more wildfires or whatever else, you know. Keep it to the really basic stuff. And the point that you make in the film, you know, you can ask any climate scientist, point to any time in the past where CO2 has driven temperatures. Both temperature and CO2 have varied very much in the past. When in the whole of Earth's climate history can you show CO2 driving temperature? And they can't. So, I mean, what has CO2 magically changed in the past 50 years? What's going on? You know, that is a clear indicator that there's something fishy about this entire thing. So we want to, in our discussions, you'll remember, want to keep it really basic, really simple. Don't go out on a limb. Just keep it to the main points. That was, you know, and Steve Coonan's brilliant book on that, you know, is a lovely kind of pointer to that. Also to point out that the people who are talking about this, who will, you know, they're not nutcases. So we needed that rather boring bit at the beginning of the film that said, you know, actually these guys, they haven't got two heads. They're not from Mars. They're actually just, you know, clever guys. And then I suppose the rest of the film, we wanted to tackle the consensus, because that's always the thing that comes back. Once you say the science, who are you to say this when all of these, you know, decide to say otherwise. So we had to address that question of what the nature of this ridiculous consensus is that backs this. And that was a harder thing to nail down, pin down, and describe, because it's a bit more wiggly and abstract. And it's harder to illustrate as well. How do you do it with pictures and music? I mean, that's a lot of the basic thing with filmmaking, is how the hell do you turn this into, you know, a form of entertainment as well as you know, a kind of an informative thing. But also once you go out and talk to people, once you start to go out on the road and you conduct, we conducted really long interviews with a lot of these scientists. You know, they went on for, you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours each. And once you sort of you start exploring that, then the film starts to take shape anyway, because, you know, it's from what they're talking about that kind of suggests the shape of the film to a certain extent. Anyway, that was a bit waffly, but I hope
very good. I shouldn't put you on the spot here, but do you have a lot of extra footage that we could take a look at? Or that I bet there's tons of great clips that are in that extra footage that didn't make it in the movie because you didn't have time to put it all in.
There are good clips, but I tell you more than that. I think that arising from having looked back at those interviews, I think there were seeds of stuff to talk about that I didn't explore fully, that I wish I'd had the, you know, presence of mind to do. So I think it's almost more worthwhile you doing podcasts, follow-up podcasts with a lot of those guys. And I'd love to throw in some questions to them, sort of following it up, because they kind of talked loosely about things that I think, that could really do with expanding.
Okay, yeah, I would love to do a podcast just like that. So I'll take that as an action item. Let's do that for sure. I wanted to ask you about, have you done maybe 100 documentaries or some huge number of documentaries? And have you used the feedback from those to figure out what's entertaining and your experience has taught you what really works in a documentary?
I haven't produced and directed hundreds of hours, but I've the company I founded and ran for 20 years produced hundreds of hours of documentaries. So I executive produced hundreds of hours, which means I sort of got to boss everyone else around. It means I didn't have to actually go around and do lots of the work. The nice thing about coming from commercial TV is that it's very competitive. You know, if you do a show that doesn't rate very well, you don't get recommissioned. So you need to always have a mind on, you know, viewers and getting them in and keeping them. So it does hone your sort of a sense of, you know, you've got to put on a show. You've got to make it entertaining. And I find that with my own films, I'm a bit more self-indulgent. I kind of do them so I'm entertaining myself a little bit. You know, and that's reflected a bit in the films. I like all that daft old music, and I like the daft old footage, and I like a commentary that's a little bit formal, but a little bit cheeky and sarcastic side of beneath the surface sort of stuff. So that tends to come out. But I think that if it's really interesting what you're saying, then that, you know, keeps it going an awful lot. And this is an amazing subject. I mean, to have something like climate, which is such a huge story, which, if, you know, the policies based on this scare are affecting people in such a profound way in the West, for there not to be any kickback, for the debate to be so one-sided, for there not to be a debate, that's such an amazing story itself that, in a way, it's hard not to do an interesting con on that.
Yeah, so I would like all the ordinary people who are being, their lives are being made worse by this scam. I hope they do watch this movie and pass it around, including like maybe the Dutch farmers, if they're trying to push the farmers off their land for some climate scam reason. I hope that this gives them some knowledge to push back even harder against that crazy.
Absolutely. I mean, a mate of mine who's also is a plumber, my plumbing whenever he goes wrong, you know, was at the London premiere and just absolutely loved it because, you know, him and sort of plenty of others, real people who do real jobs, you know, that's the sort of skeptical heartland, if you know what I mean. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. That I've said elsewhere that this whole scam is an attack on working people, on real people that have real jobs. We've got to get rid of farmers because we don't, they're plowing up the land. We can't have that. Just totally crazy. We got to support real people with real jobs. And I think this movie does a great job of that.
How has your view of things changed? I mean, you've done how many podcasts on this now?
Just over 200.
200. So, and you started off, a greenie, or at least buying into the climate thing, I don't know, but when you did your first podcast, I don't know how much of a skeptic you were then, but how has your understanding of it developed and, you know, over the past couple of years?
Yeah, I was definitely a skeptic in 2022 when I started doing the podcast. I was a skeptic already, but I feel like my knowledge is way wider and deeper now. Just talking to all these people, it's just amazing that so many people have dug into all these rabbit holes so very, very deep, like geologic heats and just all sorts of different things. So it really has helped me to listen carefully. The first time I hear something as they talk about it, but then as I'm going through and editing one or two more times, I'm learning way more in time two or three when I can really stop and think about it and maybe go with Google. And if they say something I don't understand, I can Google it and stuff. So it's the second or third time through these podcasts that I'm really learning more and more. I wish I could remember everything, but it's hard to remember everything that everybody said. But it is true that I believed in this. I was a casual believer back in 2005 or so. That I just believed experts saying the Earth's getting too hot. That's a problem. I did not climate march or anything, but I'm a little embarrassed at how naive I was back then. I tended to believe way more things then than I do now.
Yeah, but you've become along the way a fantastic kind of spokesman for the cause because you've been exposed to so many people and their arguments that actually because you've been doing a lot of podcasts as guest rather than host now, haven't you? So just, I think. Yeah. You're, and as you know, I'm always, whenever anyone approaches me to go on their podcast, they say, get Tom, put Tom on, not me, because I tend to sort of hum and haw and swear and all that sort of thing and go around the houses. But you're a fantastic, if you don't mind me saying, champion for the cause.
Oh, thank you. I'm doing the best I can. One thing I've really enjoyed over time is just being on Twitter and even in Blogspot back in the day is that I've been exposed to so many arguments from the other side that I've constantly, I feel like I've heard every possible argument over and over. And I have read all their books. Like I watched Gore's movie multiple times and I read his book and all this stuff. And I think it's so different. There's so many skeptics that are like me that have kind of devoured this, both sides of the argument. And I can tell that almost everybody on the other side, they have just immediately dismissed anything that skeptic has said, and they know they're right. And a lot of them have this cartoonish view of what a skeptic is, that we all have black mustaches and we're tying people to the railroad tracks or whatever. And I think this movie is showing that, like you said, you got Steve Coonan looking like an ordinary person, which of course he is. I think even that part helps people to realize that there are two sides. Like you said, it's not really a debate, but the people who disagree with the narrative are totally normal people and they're actually correct.
Yeah. I quite, in a funny sort of way, in a perverse sort of way, I quite like the bum baddie kind of thing where, you know, Tom Nelson probably lives in an underground volcano and there's lots of people in uniforms on going around on monorails with Kalashnikovs, something like that. You know, the demonization is is hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, again, they're thinking that we're all super old people sitting on a pile of money and we hate our kids. A lot of people who don't have kids think that I hate kids. And again, it's all a cartoon character thing and none of it is.
Yeah, and the fossil fuel money, you know, they're being paid by, that's the guy comes up again and again and again. And I'm, oh my God. And if BP turned around and offered me a huge check, believe me, I'd take it. Sadly, the check is really slow on arriving.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that they just keep saying that with absolutely zero evidence, which is it's totally not true in any way.
Another thing that I was encouraged by, and I'd like to get your opinion on whether it's changing. A lot of the people who have said positive things about the film aren't from the unknown skeptics, you know, are people whose interests are more broad politically. So, for example, Julia Hartley Brewer, who's a big media figure over here, and Alison Pearson and people like that who haven't really expressed any interest in the climate in the past have sort of said, oh, yeah, do you think there's a sense in which people are realizing this climate thing isn't just about the climate, actually, it's about something much, much bigger socially and politically?
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is, like you said, if we step back and look at the big picture, that the whole thing is so stupid that we're supposed to think that CO2 causes bad weather, and it falls at the first hurdle because the weather isn't getting worse. You point that out in the film. the weather is not getting worse. So this whole idea that we're going to spend $50 trillion, blah, 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 to prevent it from getting worse, the whole $50 trillion is blown. And I think people are figuring that out, that they don't have to be a climatologist. They don't have to know everything about exactly how greenhouse gases work and all that stuff. They don't have to. They can just look at the big picture, and that's enough.
What now in terms of publicizing the film? We need to get hold of Joe Rogan and all these sort of people to get endorsements, don't we? It's interesting politically, the sort of people who are likely to endorse and the people who are not likely to endorse. I mean, it really does divide along political lines. So we're not there's, I'm reluctant to say left and right, because what it also exposes, what interested me in the making of it is the difference in what we mean by left and right. That's sort of, you know, brought into question by the whole climate thing. Because on the one hand, left wingers, you know, buy into the climate thing, but on the other hand, the climate thing involves really dumping on ordinary people, higher taxes, higher regulation, and so on. It really highlights the fact that the left now really means big state. It doesn't mean pro-worker. The right has shifted as well. You know, the right used to mean, oh, you like toffs and posh people and rich people, and so on. And now the right seems to be very populist. You know, it's ordinary people are what's deemed to be right wing. So I think that is a lovely change in politics as a whole. That's kind of being highlighted by the climate issue. I don't know what you think about that.
Absolutely. And that brings up this whole book that I think you were working on, your New Class book, back in October 22 when I interviewed you. You were talking about writing a book, and that may have been your New Class book that you're working on again now. But yeah, let's talk about that. That I just did put a PDF teaser on my Substack, and it's brilliant stuff about this whole new class. But do you want to mention that one?
Yes, I'm working on a book that I'm sure no one will publish and no one will read. But you put a bit of it on your Substack, so maybe two people might look at it before getting really bored by the said paragraph. But that explores precisely this: what the realignment of politics. Actually, I don't think it's a realignment. I think that it was a misalignment all along, and that we're just sort of cottoning on to the fact that socialists are in fact anti-working class, that anti-capitalists are anti-working class, and the working class is particularly keen on freedom and free markets and capitalism. I think we're so used to thinking about politics in a way that's determined by socialist intellectuals and Marxist intellectuals that's kind of clouded what the true nature of things is. And I think that's beginning, the clouds are beginning to shift away. And I hope the book does something towards that.
Do you have an elevator pitch yet, or maybe that was it, about what the new class is? Any minute or two
I suppose it's there are very loose terms for this group of people that we are suspicious of, but at the moment don't understand them properly. We refer to the blob, the elite, and the swamp, and there are these rather amorphous terms for this thing we don't like, but is hard to define. And in a sense, the purpose of the book is to define that group and to say that it's not just a little old group in society like big finance or the trade union movement or something like that. Actually, it's an entire social class. And it's a social class that constitutes the ruling class. The book argues that it's a myth. Just because we're in a society that we call capitalist, it's a myth that the ruling class is capitalist or pro-capitalist. If it was, taxes would be really low and there'd be hardly any regulation. It's clear that the capitalist class, if you will, which hardly exists as a class, is not in charge. There's another class in charge, and they do like high taxes and they do like heavy regulation. They are anti-capitalist. We have an anti-capitalist ruling class. That's the weird thing that people don't realize. And this form of anti-capitalism is not in favor of liberating and enriching the workers. On the contrary, it's in favor of milking the workers, taking their money off them and constraining them. And that's what the book argues, that it's all that things are topsy-turvy. They're not what you what they appear. Capitalism is not this wicked exploitative thing. It's actually this enormously liberating thing that ordinary people love, which is why they're not building rafts on beaches in Florida in order to escape to Cuba. And they're not, and they weren't hopping over the Berlin Wall in order to go east. It was always in order to go west. And they're not desperate to get from South Korea to North Korea and so on and so forth. You know, ordinary people, they want to go to the most capitalist countries around. They want to go to America. So they were, you know, Americans aren't lining up to try and get into Mexico. They're, you know, people that want to go to the most advanced capitalist countries because they're the really exciting places to be. And I remember when I was an old commie years ago when I was young, trying to sell my ridiculous left-wing sort of newspapers and magazines outside tube stations. Working class people wouldn't have anything to do with me, you know, as I was, you know, singing the praises of living under communism. They just sold off, you know, no way. You know, the ordinary people, they didn't want to live in Soviet Russia. They wanted to go to America. And the only people that, you know, bought their papers were upper middle class university students. They were the ones, you know, it's the intelligentsia who have embraced socialism. And it's the intelligentsia who embrace the state because, you know, no one in an ordinary company would want to employ anyone who's a member of the intelligentsia. So they need the state in order to get an income and get some status. But anyway, that wasn't much of an elevator pitch, was it? Because it went on too long. I need to own it and refine it. But anyway, that's the nature of the book. But it also then goes back into history and really to describe, it's mainly a history book. So it describes how capitalism arose, how feudalism turned into capitalism, the liberating forces that were at work in that, liberating and enriching for ordinary people. You know, the argument is that capitalism actually was a workers' revolution. That's the truth of it. And likewise, the origins of the new class, which was the religious clerisy, you know, whose job it was to stop you thinking and stop you criticizing and stop you challenging the status quo. And we're entirely parasitic. I mean, people don't realize that, you know, the medieval Catholic Church was the biggest owner of serfs in, you know, feudalism. You know, they were the single biggest owner of serfs, slaves, effectively. So that was the new class. That was the sort of historic origins. But anyway, that's all that book's all about. That. I mean, you know, how boring is that? No one is going to read that.
Okay, so you're so humble about this, but I could not disagree more. I think it's absolutely freaking brilliant. I even used capital letters when I told you that via email, that I've read the first 37 pages and everybody should read those 37 pages. So it is up on my Substack and it has great relevance to the movie, right? Because it's kind of a companion piece as to what's behind this whole climate scam, right? Would you agree that it's a major portion of what...
The climate scare is absolutely squarely the product of the new class, and the new class has created it, it defends it, it polices it, and that's why there's a kind of the moral aspect to climate. You know, if you're skeptical, as you know, in certain circles, it's not just that you've expressed an opinion on a scientific question, you're a bad person. You've crossed the line, and that's the truth of a lot of things in new class circles. If you contradict, if you rock the boat in terms of new class ideology, you're on the outside. You know, it's a social faux pas. It's a breach of social etiquette, and you face social ostracism for doing it. I mean, they're that tightly controlled, and it's a really subtle form of control. You know, that it doesn't need a law to do it. You know, such is their grip of culture in a way that they can kind of police thinking in that way.
So I'm just going to throw this out publicly, as I did privately earlier, that if you were to spend 2 hours reading this whole thing into a microphone, and if I were to publish this as a podcast, I think enormous amounts of people would listen to it. And as they're driving around, they would love it to hear your dulcet tones talking about all this stuff. I think fantastic. So I'm really, really hoping that you do it. I think, tons of people need to consume this material because it's so important to find out, to learn more about what's behind the climate scam. And a movie would be even better, but you're not ready to make a movie on the new class yet, are you? or are you?
Well, I think I'm. In fact, someone came up to me the other day and suggested I make a film about the swamp, and even suggested they could get a Trump friend and things like that. But I mentioned it to the wife, and she went ballistic. So I think I might have to leave it a few months for her to calm down before I do that again. I mean, you know, Kate, she's a very forceful personality, and she doesn't have quite the stomach for controversy that I do. So I won't dive into one straight away. But your invitation to read the first part of the book is a really generous and flattering one, and I will put on my best Rex Harrison voice and try to do it. So you're quite right. It'd be good to get it out there.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
And thank you for saying such nice things about it as well. You're about the first person to actually read that first section of the book, and the fact that you said such nice things about it was extremely encouraging.
No, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. It's not just me being nice. It's great stuff. So maybe Kate would be okay with you just reading stuff in her microphone. She's okay with that.
I think she can cope with that. I think for to make another film, you'll have to come back over to London, and we'll have to have a couple of nights out.
So, by the way, multiple people thought that it was David Attenborough doing the narration for Climate the Movie. I don't know how that would work, but I guess you have a voice that sounds like his.
Attenborough, I think I'm slightly more lively than whispering David Attenborough. But the trouble is I tend to put on, as soon as I'm doing a sort of voiceover for thing, I tend to put on my very posh sort of English voice. I can't seem to help it. And so I do sound a bit BBC when I do those voiceovers.
I'm curious, how long did it take to do the voiceovers? Because if I was to try that, I would have a million takes and it would take forever. But I bet you just did it, right?
I've done it many times before, so I'm used to it. So I put on my silly voice and then I can do it in a couple of hours.
Okay, excellent. Let's see. Anything else you want to share about the process of making the movie? I think people are really interested in that. Did you spend a lot of time just in your office there with bits of video up on a couple of screens and testing out stuff? And a separate question is, did you have to pay for a lot of that archival footage, or was it just a freely available old music and footage?
No, you have to pay for everything, sadly. Okay. And also, because we wanted the film to go everywhere, you have to pay for it worldwide rights in perpetuity, as they call it, so that it's the film can be watched indefinitely and anywhere on whatever platform. So that's a bit expensive. And also finding out, obviously, you cut and you recut, and this bit works and that doesn't work, and you realize it's boring in the middle, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of toing and froing, trying to get it right, get the flow of the and the one big, as you know, one big problem was the second half, really sort of working out what the argument was in terms of the consensus, getting that in a straight line I think now, hopefully, it seems fairly logical and obvious, and it's obvious to me now that that's what the film should argue. But it wasn't obvious a few months back. It was the first early cuts of the film were going on and on and on and on. And I was thinking, oh, this isn't at all clear. And partly because my thinking wasn't clear. The lovely thing about having to make a film is that it forces you to think clearly about a problem. So that was a big tussle. Getting the end argument vaguely right, that was hard. And even when I thought we did have the argument right about the consensus, getting it into a nutshell was hard, because it's sort of a complicated argument. If you're arguing that there is an entire class of people who have an intuitive liking for this scare, that's quite a big claim. And if you state it too directly and abruptly, it looks too much like a conspiracy theory, as people like to sort of dismiss them. You know, if you think, oh yeah, who says that? That's just a rather wild assertion. So you've got to kind of build into it a little bit, and doing that in a very short space of time in a film is quite tricky. But one thing that was an absolute pleasure, was first of all working with a producer who knew the subject really well, because normally when I make a film, I'm working with a producer who's experienced in TV but not in other ways, and also politically aligned. I think if you had been a lukewarmer or had not had the political perspective that you have, I think we'd have had a much harder time making the film because, you know, we'd have been tussling a bit more. But the nice thing is, I mean, I think pretty early on, we realized we were absolutely in tune and in agreement about the nature of the climate scare, not just the science, but the politics around it. And so that's been the fact that we agreed was so important in the making of the film. And also the fact that you had such a fantastic resource in your podcasts. I mean, you've got the entire skeptic community and more on speed dial. So, you know, I really didn't have to do any digging around the burden of research was greatly lightened by the fact that you've got this entire resource at your fingertips and in your brain. So in that sense, it's been a real pleasure to make the film. And it's much better because of it. You know, I didn't have to fight any other battles along the way.
Very, very good. Thank you for the kind words there. One thing I wanted to mention is tons of people have given me feedback that they love the ending of the movie. They love the Canadian truckers. I don't know if you're hearing a lot of that too, but that's popular. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially in Canada. Yeah. They love all that. Well, I think it's sort of struck a nerve. People are starting to fight back. And also, it's not normally described as a class struggle, the climate issue. So I think that's, in a way, that's one new thing that we're bringing with the film, the class dimension to this. But intuitively, people kind of know that's true. I mean, you know, if you go into any social gathering, you can tell that if you're in a sports bar with guys who work in construction and haulage or whatever else, you're likely to, you know, meet with a great deal of climate skepticism or cynicism or whatever you want to call it, or total indifference at the very least. Whereas if you are in an art gallery and you're mixing with some, you know, senior lecturers in sociology or whatever else, then, you know, it's the opposite. So people understand intuitively that there's a kind of a class divide going on there, but really taking that to the next level and explaining why that is and what's behind it. Hopefully we've advanced that a little bit in the film. People just, you know, that clip of people in the East End trying to get to work, and there's a couple of, you know, green activists on the train stopping them from getting their work, and you can feel the hate for these Greens. I remember years ago making a series about gangsters with gangsters, which is a fairly hairy thing to do, but nevertheless, you know, sort of like, and I remember there was this great, it was about different kind of gangs in London, and there's a big Jewish sort of gang mafia thing. Historically, there was a Jewish gangster, I won't say his name, don't libel, and he's saying, Martin, he's saying, yeah. I was saying, so what have you been doing? X, what is his name? He said, yeah, there's been this climate march down in London. So we went down there. And I said, hey, you went down on that, on a climate march? He says, yeah, yeah, yeah. We feel the guards. We go down there, and when the coppers aren't looking, we thump the we thump the marchers. You know, just such cunts, you know? So we just got an age, it was such good fun. And these sort of, when they just hated these, you know, Wally, upper middle class, university educated Greens grinding on about, and they weren't consciously pro-capitalist or anything like that, but they just smelled that these people were sort of, you know, people they didn't like. And so for amusement, they go down and thump a few.
That's great. At some of the premieres I was at, when they would show for the movie, they would show the footage of people getting dragged off the top of the train. They were clapping and cheering in the audience. People love that. Yeah.
Bit of direct action.
Yeah, that's wonderful stuff.
Funny, during the Brexit thing, you know, everyone was putting posters in their window, either sort of, you know, remain in the EU or leave. In the entire street, I was the only one with a Leave poster in the big, apart from this wonderful, I used to have a piano teacher, very old Jewish Hungarian woman called Marty Claire down the street, and she had a Leave one too.
Okay.
She used to say, I've survived fascism and I've survived communism. I'm damned if I'm going to end up in Europe again. But But yeah, we were the only ones with lead posters. And my wife used to complain because we would get so, people would sort of hurl abuse as they wandered past the door and with our Brexit posters. So they would sort of be in the window and then they'd come up out of the window and be scrumpled up. And then we'd have it. But she said, well, yeah. I said, it's not reasonable that they're allowed to have theirs. And so we'd iron the poster and it would go back up. And so this poster would keep going. And quite clear we're having a series of domestics between this poster going in and out the window. But yeah, no, it's a very climatey, except for working class areas here, which are sort of, you know, again, you know, you see the class divide on skepticism very much. It's really among the kind of the trendy, cultured upper middle classes that you get the real climate warriors. As you, I mean, but you know, you've been to this area, so you know the smell of it.
Well, I did think of my final question, I think, here is that, do you think these, the new class, they seriously think that they're going to force this dystopia on the working people where we're living in 15-minute cities and we're eating fake meat and bugs and we can't go on vacation? Do they seriously think that we're going to just sit still and we're going to say, okay, we're going to do this because we think it's going to prevent bad weather in 2050? That's a serious thing?
Well, I think the really sinister thing about the new class, although numerically they're not a huge class, they have enormous amount of power in terms of their control of the media, control of schools, control of universities, control of politics. You know, you look at green parties in the UK, the Green Party has one MP. It's managed to elect one MP. We have 600-odd MPs in Parliament. They've got one. And support among the working class for green politics is zero, statistically zero. You know, it's it's not even 1% support for the Greens and green policy. But in terms of politics, you cannot find a major political party that is anti-green. You know, they've got that layer of society stitched up: the civil service, the science and arts establishments, the education establishment, the media. So I think they think, I mean, okay, so what if the workers grumble? What if the window cleaners don't like, you know, having to go the long way around, you know, all the rest of it? What are they going to do? What are they going to do? Who are you going to vote for? Because there is no one, you know, politically saying, we're going to ditch all this. We're going to get rid of all the codswallop of net zero. We're going to ditch it. So although it's a small class, the new class is immensely powerful and very cocky. It's, you know, sort of says, you know, what are you going to do? So it's very hard. And you know, we've got some great kind of little guerrilla working class movements in London at the moment going around sawing down the cameras. You know, we've got cameras that see where you're going, and they're destroying cameras. They're sawing them down, all this sort of thing. They call them blade runners.
Any final things you want to say before you go ahead and walk your dog?
No, just what a total, just officially say now what total pleasure it's been working with you over the past year, and how I look for whatever shape it takes. I look forward to working with you more in the future. And I still say to any podcasters who want someone on to talk about climate that you're the guy.
All right. Thank you very much. And the feeling is mutual. I've totally enjoyed working with you. It's been fantastic. I hope to do a lot more of it. So I'll let you go, but thanks for doing this one. Talk to you later, Martin Durkin.
Peace, Tom.